Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first committee meeting of the Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee. We're going to start with the come to order, and DJ, will you please call the roll?
Chair Leak.
Here.
Vice Chair Payne.
Here.
Ranking Member Casello.
Here.
Bell has been excused. Byrd.
Here.
Clemmons.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
DiLombardo.
Here.
Goff Marcil. Jenny?
Here.
Mariano?
Here.
McFarland?
Here.
Smith?
Here.
Snyder?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
Tribolsi has been excused. Williamson?
Here.
Zika?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, DJ. I want to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. I realize we're all getting back into this, but if you could help me and get back into the groove and remember to silence your cell phone, I'm going to start by silencing mine. Members, welcome to the Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee. As you know, we have been living through unprecedented times, and I know that we're all tired of hearing that we're living through unprecedented times, but I think it is an apt description. But we're living through unprecedented times, presenting new challenges daily to Floridians, their businesses, the healthcare industry, and all levels of government. Besides our current situation, Florida is regularly presented with both immediate and long-term public emergencies that require diligent planning and preparation. Our work will be to explore those issues appropriate for legislative action and leave Florida in a better place for future emergencies. Today, we have DJ Ellerkamp joining us. DJ will be serving as the committee's administrative assistant. Also joining us today from the committee staff is our analyst, Gene Landry. Although not attending the committee meeting due to COVID protocols limiting staff attendance, the committee staff also includes staff attorneys Douglas McElarney and Zach Nations, along with legislative intern Roberta Skinner. Tom Hamby is filling in today on a temporary basis as staff director. And finally, Whitney Hall from the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee is with us today in case we need to call on her experience. Normally, at our first committee meeting, we would take the time at the beginning to introduce ourselves. However, since our time is limited, I'd like us to get straight to work. And if time permits, at the end, we will take time to introduce ourselves as we move through introductions. Before we proceed, I would like for us to share a moment of silence in memory of those who have lost their lives due to COVID-19 and the members of their family. Thank you. On today's agenda, we'll be considering one bill, the consideration of HB 9, Protecting Consumers Against Fraud During a Pandemic by Representative Zika. We also have Director Moskowitz, thank you, sir, from the Division of Emergency Management on the COVID-19 vaccination planning and implementation. To discuss the issue on the bill of vaccine fraud, I've asked the Attorney General's Office to brief us on the vaccine fraud issue and what they've been doing and working on to address it. With us is John Gard, Chief Deputy Attorney General. Mr. Gard, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. On behalf of the attorney, can everyone hear me now? Okay.
Make sure you've enabled the microphone, please.
I think it's green, so.
They're new, we're all getting used to them. It's a button, should be a button on the panel down there.
Okay, I'm good. All right, thank you. Thank you, Chair. I would first like to start off by thanking the Speaker, Chair Leak, and this committee's members for dealing with the unprecedented issues that COVID-19 presents our state. I would also be remiss if I did not, on behalf of the Attorney General, thank the Governor for his steadfast leadership and his hard work dealing with the pandemic and protecting all Floridians. Like the rest of state government, COVID-19 has presented a set of unique challenges never encountered before by the Department of Legal Affairs. While the Department of Legal Affairs had dealt with one prior health-related emergency declaration connected to the Zika virus, Zika's impact is not, frankly, in the same universe as COVID-19. As of last week, the Department of Legal Affairs Consumer Protection Division has had more than 14,318 consumer contacts related to COVID-19. To put that in context, The typical named storm directly impacting the state of Florida causes less than 3,000 consumer contacts. In other words, COVID-19 has caused the equivalent in consumer contacts of more than 4 named storms directly striking the state of Florida over the last almost year. Even before the governor issued his first executive order, Attorney General Moody was focused on protecting Florida's consumers from COVID-19 scams. The Attorney General ensured from day one that the Consumer Protection Division had the resources and support necessary to respond to the flood of complaints that we were receiving. The earnest and hardworking employees of the Department of Legal Affairs have answered the challenges presented by COVID-19, have adapted to the new environment that it has caused, and continue to protect Florida's consumers. I'm thankful for their hard work, and I am proud of what they have done and continue to do. The Attorney General at the beginning of the pandemic held calls with commercial internet platforms and other retailers to create processes with each so that we can quickly escalate suspected scam posts and have them removed. And through the escalation process, we have caused to be removed hundreds of internet posts that sought to take advantage of Florida's consumers. The Attorney General also directed collaboration between our Consumer Protection Division and federal and state law enforcement partners to ensure that not only were the complaints we were receiving being looked at for civil enforcement, but that they were also being looked at for criminal enforcement. And finally, General Moody recognized from the beginning that if we educated consumers early enough, we could avoid some of them being scammed. The department has issued numerous press releases and publications attempting to disseminate in real time the latest information to Florida's consumers regarding the scams the department was seeing in its complaints and how to avoid them. At each stage of the pandemic, we have seen scammers and fraudsters try to take advantage of Florida consumers and the deadly fear that COVID-19 has caused. The Consumer Protection Division saw scams in its complaints when there was a shortage of masks, gloves, and protective personal equipment. The division has seen similar scams in its complaints with respect to the rollout of testing and offers of treatments and cures for COVID-19. And with the high demand of vaccine, we expect to see additional scams or attempts to defraud Floridians with vaccine distribution and rollout. We are monitoring reports in other jurisdictions and believe it's only a matter of time before we have active reports of scams here. At each stage of the pandemic, we have utilized the power that the legislature has already provided the department under Florida's Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act to investigate, take down, and stop false and misleading scams of Florida consumers. FDUPTA, as we call it, is a broad statute with a good number of tools in it, but the Attorney General would welcome additional tools and clearer authority in this context to respond to these unprecedented challenges. The Attorney General is committed to work with the legislature to ensure that Floridians are fully protected. Again, I and the Attorney General thank you for your service and your work in this important area.
Thank you, Mr. Gard. Members, are there any questions for Mr. Gard? Members? Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Gard. We appreciate your time here. The bill up for consideration today is House Bill 9, Protecting Consumers Against Fraud During a Pandemic, by Representative Zika. Can we all take a moment and chuckle that Representative Zika is presenting a vaccine bill? Representative Zika, you are recognized to present the bill.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Thank you, sir.
Well, good morning, Chairman Leak, Vice Chairman Payne, and Ranking Member Casello, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 9, Protecting Consumers Against Fraud During a Pandemic. House Bill 9 establishes criminal penalties and authorizes civil remedies to protect Floridians from fraud as they seek to get vaccinated during a pandemic. Recently, the federal, state, and local officials have warned Florida consumers to be careful of offers to get special access to the COVID-19 vaccines in exchange for money. They often use these fraudsters, authentic-looking but fake websites, to lure unsuspecting consumers into paying for vaccines or appointments that never materialize. This piece of legislation, members, sends a loud and clear message to the fraudsters. The Florida House of Representatives will protect Florida consumers against fraud during a pandemic. This is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Zika. Are there any amendments? Seeing no amendments, are there any questions on the bill? Members, are there any questions? Seeing no questions on the bill, is there any public testimony? Thank you. Is Maureen Van Hoke here from Health Freedom Florida? All right, seeing that Ms. Van Hoke is not here, we'll pass it. We have Ms. Zane Smith from AARP. Is she here? She is waving in support. Thank you. We have Lauren Mariano. Is Lauren Mariano here? Are you waving in support? Yes, waving in support? Okay, thank you for waving in support. That concludes the public testimony. Is there anyone else for public testimony? Seeing no other public testimony, is there any debate? Seeing no debate, Ranking Member Casello, you're recognized.
Not so much a debate, Chair. It's just an observation. I'd just like to thank the representative coming right out of the gate with something that's going to set a guideline for our residents here in Florida. I think this is needed, and hopefully we can even expand on this down the line. It's a great bill, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Ranking Member Casello.
Thank you. Any other debate? Seeing no other debate, Representative Zika, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is an important legislation that protects Florida consumers against fraud during a pandemic. I want to take this moment to thank Chair Leak and Vice Chair and the Ranking Member for their support and the committee members. And personally, I want to thank our Speaker, Speaker Sprouls, for his leadership on this important piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I ask for your favorable support, members. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zeke, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward and helping to protect Floridians against fraud in this from those who are just opportunists in this moment. So thank you. DJ, please call the roll on House Bill 9 and announce the vote.
Representative's bill has been excused. Byrd?
Yes.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Driscoll?
Yes.
Gilombardo?
Yes.
Goff-Marcil?
Yes.
Jenny?
Yes.
Mariano? McFarland?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Tribulsi has been excused. Williamson?
Yes.
Zika?
Yes.
Chair Leak?
Yes.
The bill passes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, DJ. Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Zika.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, members, and this is where I wanted us to have sufficient time to make sure that we can get our own questions answered and a better understanding of how the state of Florida is dealing with the vaccine and the distribution. So next up, we will hear from Jared Moskowitz, the Director of the Division of Emergency Management on COVID-19 Vaccination Planning and Implementation. Director Moskowitz, thank you for being here. You are recognized.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members. Thank you for inviting me here today. I, for one, am very happy to see you. And I'm grateful, Mr. Chairman, that unlike your previous roles, you did not have to subpoena me here today.
So am I.
So because we've not really had the opportunity to discuss everything that has gone on since March, I want to spend a little time going backwards. Because while the vaccine has been going on for 5 weeks, we at the division have been fighting COVID-19 since March. And so I'll do that as fast as I can because I want to get to the vaccine, but I want to give you the full picture of what we've been working on. So the governor declared a public health emergency on March 1st. He declared a state of emergency on March 9th to have the division assist the Department of Health in their response. We would soon be operating under the first 50-state disaster declaration in American history. And now we are at day 314 at a level 1, the longest mission ever, not by double, not by triple. In the first 90 days, we had received over 30,000 mission requests, three times the size of a Category 5 hurricane. From day one, the division has been extremely aggressive to make sure Florida has its resources. Back in March, when there were no COVID tests, we procured tests. We got tests up and running in a matter of weeks. Then there was a national swab shortage. We procured swabs internationally to make sure we could expand testing. We opened more than 85 state testing sites with dozens upon dozens of state-supported testing sites by partnering with counties using CARES Act funding. We have tested almost 5 million people in the state of Florida, done over 200,000 tests in a single day, and have averaged recently 1.5 million tests every 2 weeks. We made sure testing was available and accessible in minority communities and worked with partners to establish testing in migrant communities who help put food on the table. And when we opened these sites, we made sure to communicate in English, Spanish, and Creole. We helped support testing in the homelessness community in Miami-Dade, making sure even the most vulnerable among us have access. We led the nation right out of the gate in rapid testing, even while some states had to form consortiums because they couldn't get supply. We worked with the private sector to create a massive testing infrastructure with Walmart, CVS, Walgreens, and help jumpstart our economy and assist essential workers by opening sites in places like Home Depot, Publix, and Simon Malls. We bought a mobile lab, first in the country, to do mobile rapid PCR testing in order to travel to every nook and cranny of the state. And we tested 1.5 million residents and staff in 90 days, the first and largest logistics testing mission of its kind in the country in long-term care facilities. When the summer spike happened, we provided more than 2,500 medical personnel to hospitals to expand bed capacity and give overworked hospital staff a break. We staged 5 field hospitals, transformed the Miami Beach Convention Center into a 450-bed hospital with the Army Corps of Engineers. We converted a hospital in Miami that wasn't operational into an operational facility. But unlike many other states, especially states our size, thankfully, we didn't have to use any of them, but we were prepared. And in order to help slow the spread, especially in Dade County, especially among multi-generational families, we opened 2 isolation hotels so people did not have to go home when they had COVID. But nothing was like the fight for PPE. We needed to protect our frontline healthcare workers, our doctors, our nurses, our firefighters, our EMTs, our police officers, the heroes on the front lines fighting COVID. The world had no PPE. We did whatever it took, bought it from whoever had it, put eggs in every basket, in what would become a search for masks that led to empty warehouses, phantom planes with no masks. We worked it hard every day, 24 hours, like a boiler room. We did whatever we could to save a life, and we refused to put a cost on what saving a doctor or a nurse's life would be. We convinced the federal administration to focus the Production Act on 3M, which would lead to 50 million more masks coming into the country every month. To date, the Division of Emergency Management has sent 80 million masks, 21 million gloves to communities around the state, 15 million masks to long-term care facilities, 5 million gloves, 3 million gowns to all our nursing homes and ALFs. We sent 1 million masks to the prison system and 6 million masks to schools. Unlike many other states, we also had to prepare for hurricane season while fighting a pandemic. Not to mention, it was the most active hurricane season ever on record. We led the country and teamed up with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate and Brock Long to create non-congregate or hotels as shelters, guidance that many states would copy. We led the effort to get FEMA to make this reimbursable. And since we can walk and chew gum at the same time while fighting COVID-19, the division has paid out more than $800 million for statewide hurricane reimbursement since March, for a total of $3.6 billion since I took over the division. We distributed more than $600 million local CARES Act dollars down to the local level, beyond what the counties that received money directly from the federal government. And because Congress finally passed the COVID-19 package, Florida is slated to get $194 million for vaccine distribution and $1.2 billion for testing and mitigation to offset the costs that the state has had to spend fighting COVID-19. But now, let's get to the last 5 weeks, and I'll go a little slower now. So look, it was the scientific breakthrough that we all prayed for, getting a vaccine in less than a year. And with Operation Warp Speed providing the funding for the Moderna vaccine and money for the Pfizer production, every state was told to prepare for doses increasing week over week. So of course we prepared. In June, we ordered 5 million syringes, 5 million Band-Aids, and 5 million alcohol swabs to make sure we had extra supplies in the event there was a shortage. We acquired 2 industrial dry ice machines as the federal government was concerned about dry ice supply for the Pfizer vaccine. So in week one, we find out our allocations. We find our allocations in a system called Tiberius. This is the federal system that's provided by Operation Warp Speed. The problem? The problem is we can only see 6 days ahead. Not 2 weeks, not 3 weeks, but 6 days. We find out on a Tuesday what we're gonna get the following Monday. So when people say, where is the long-range planning? The federal government doesn't tell us. They don't tell me what I'm getting in 2 months. They don't tell me what I'm getting next month. I can't tell you what I'm getting in 2 weeks. So the federal government instructed us for the first doses that we would follow CDC guidance 1A and that it would go to hospitals for frontline healthcare workers. The federal government said we can only pick 5 hospitals in the whole state. So we had to pick 5 hospitals, we picked the largest systems, and it had to have ultra cold chain storage. So we received 179,400 doses of the Pfizer vaccine in the very first week. 5 pilot hospitals were chosen, but we had more vaccine than they had frontline healthcare workers or that healthcare workers were willing to take it. So what we did was we had those 5 hospitals partner with an additional 25 hospitals in neighboring areas for a total of 30 hospitals for the first week of distribution. Long-term care facilities was the other part of the CDC 1A, as far as who was gonna get it first, frontline healthcare workers, folks in long-term care facilities. But because the federal government long-term care contract was prohibited from starting for several weeks, we found that unacceptable. We wanted to get a jump start. So we were the first in the country to go into long-term care facilities. We picked Pinellas and Broward County due to their concentration of long-term care facilities, and the state, before the federal government contract ever started, went into 100 facilities in just 6 days. Then in week two, we received 127,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine and 367,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine, which was immediately sent to more than 170 hospital locations that span the entire state, again, according with the CDC guidance of 1A. So that week, we received almost 500,000 doses. I want you to remember that number. In week two, we received almost 500,000 doses. Governor DeSantis signed an executive order to give vaccination priority to seniors 65 and older. We did that because we wanted to make sure that we could help the most vulnerable among us. 80% of our deaths in the state are in the 65 and older demographic. Let me repeat, 80% of our deaths are in the 65 and older demographic in our state. And with 4.3 million seniors in that demographic, time was of the essence in order to save lives and reduce the burden on our healthcare system. Week two, we realized hospitals are not moving fast enough. One reason is they believe they have to split their allocation and hold on to doses for the second shot, even though that's not what we told them, even though that's not what the CDC told them, and even though that's not what Operation Warp Speed told them. Why? Why was that happening? It was happening because when they asked us when we were receiving their second dose, we couldn't tell them. We couldn't instill the confidence in the hospital system that they were getting their second dose because we weren't provided the date of delivery because we only get information 6 days at a time. Hospitals felt they had a moral obligation to hold on to those doses until we could provide them information, adding delay. Then in week three, we get 280,000 doses. Week two, we got 500,000. We were told doses were gonna ramp up week over week. Week two, we get 500,000. Week three, 280,000. An almost 50% decline from the previous week. This was not what we planned on. The plans were built around doses increasing week over week, as Operation Warp Speed told us. Florida sent doses of the vaccine to all 67 county health departments because that is where the majority of the freezers were located for storage. And we sent them to FHQCs to make sure that there was vaccine available to our underserved population. The good news is, by the middle of week three, we get the information. The second shot appears in Tiberius, and we can tell the hospitals that they're gonna get the second shot. Week four, we now know we have a problem with supply, as in week four, we get 250,000, continuing to drop down from the previous week. Providers are now concerned about running out of vaccine, also leading to providers not giving it out fast enough. Instructed by the governor to assist, the Florida Division of Emergency Management immediately hires 1,000 contract nurses to support the vaccination efforts. These nurses have been deployed around the entire state to help vaccination sites that we have, that counties have, and hospitals have. These nurses will supplement the many personnel already in the field, including 800 Florida National Guardsmen who have been supporting the state's response since the beginning of the pandemic. And while the National Guard cannot do shots, let me repeat, while the National Guard cannot do shots, they are supporting all sites as they have been since March with logistical support. The Florida Division of Emergency Management evaluated all of our testing sites to see which ones could be converted, the first of which opened at the Hard Rock, which was the first testing site we opened in the state in the beginning. This site is now doing 1,000 appointments a day. And because of the vaccine disparity in the minority community and the historical vaccine hesitancy, the Florida Division of Emergency Management was the first in the nation to partner with places of worship in underserved communities where the vaccine may be administered. Having local validators on the ground, people they trust, has proven to be an avenue to gain access and subside some of that hesitancy to take the vaccine. Other states are now copying our effort. All states but West Virginia used the federal contract for long-term care facilities. We were told our facilities would be done in a matter of weeks, but when we saw the federal contract not working, Additionally, because we're not a party to the federal contract, the contractors did not believe they had to share information. So during this process, when asked how many doses they were doing or where they were, they refused to tell us. Obviously frustrated by the process, the governor instructed us to get more involved. The Florida Division of Emergency Management was asked by the governor to take on additional responsibilities, and we began helping to vaccinate 3,000 assisted living facilities across the state, supplementing and accelerating the effort done by CVS and Walgreens. Additionally, one of the things the federal government didn't tell us is in order to turn on the federal contract, they wanted the doses in hand before they would start vaccinating. So almost 185,000 doses sat idle, waiting for that program to start. Governor DeSantis also announced a state partnership with Publix supermarkets, turning on the pharmacy option before the overwhelming majority of states to establish the COVID-19 vaccination sites. We established sites in 22 stores in Marion, Hernando, and Citrus counties. This program will expand in the coming days to over 100 stores in a dozen plus counties. And if we had the supply, we could put vaccine in 700 Publixes across the state. We now have more than 70 vaccination sites that have opened in partnership with local communities and hospitals. Those vaccination sites can continue to expand with more nurses, more tents, and more throughput if we had more vaccine. Week 5, which we are now in, we received the same amount as week 4, 250,000. Let me tell you how that breaks down. We need about 40,000 doses a week for the long-term care mission. Then we need 30,000 doses for Publix, 6,000 doses for church missions. That leaves around 170,000 doses a week for 67 counties. I'll take our largest county. The smallest counties get about 100 doses a week based on 65 and older population allocations. But all of Dade County is getting 20,000 doses a week. At that pace, based on the supply controlled by the federal government, it will take 100 weeks to vaccinate the county. This is why it's a supply issue. Let me recap. To date, we have received 1.4 million first doses. Hospitals received 665,000 of those to date, and county health departments, FHQCs, received 700,000 doses to date. So people have asked about the plan. Did we have a plan? Yes, we did. Are we following the plan? Yes, we are. So what's not working? What changed? What has affected the plan? Supply, allocations, lack of information. Again, how do you do long-range planning over 6 days of information? How do you build infrastructure when information changes week to week, when allocations drop, when you have to close sites in the beginning of an operation because you can't feed them? That is what is happening. The Department of Health's plan calls for a decentralized effort. I know it feels chaotic, 67 different counties, systems, interpretations. But healthcare is delivered at the local level. It is a decentralized effort, and it's exactly what every other state is doing. Doctors, nurses, pharmacies at the local level giving out the vaccine. And the state is propping up an army of vaccinators, now up to 1,200 people that we've deployed around the state. Additionally, we're working on a registration system that we plan to launch in the coming weeks to help integrate sites registrations and fix some of the problems that we've all read about. But at the end of the day, demand exceeds the supply. There are not enough places to go, so too many people are descending on too few locations, crashing websites and call centers. It's not that we can't open more locations, it's that we can't feed those locations. We know how to do that. We've built that infrastructure. We built testing infrastructure. Vaccine infrastructure is almost identical. I have nurses in testing, I have nurses in vaccines. It's drive-throughs, it's walk-ups. Just like we couldn't feed testing centers in the beginning because there weren't enough swabs, there weren't enough tests, it's the almost identical issue. Another problem, the lag in reporting. We hear reports, articles, anecdotal evidence that hospitals are sitting on doses. Nobody is sitting on doses. But yes, there are 234,000 doses still in hospitals that they are moving through the process. But we're a big state. That's less than 800 doses a hospital. So there aren't tens of thousands of doses sitting in any one location. And they are working through those. Shots in arms save lives. Shots in arms keep people out of the hospital. But entering information into the data system is administrative work, right? While it's important to you and I so we have accurate information, people are just not entering it in a fast order. The Florida Department of Health passed a rule mandating that they enter this information within 24 hours, but they're not. This week, we did 390,000 shots, according to our information. That's a good number. It's more shots than we're receiving. But I believe that we didn't do 390,000 shots this week. I believe that's a combination of shots we did this week and people entering old information. And so when we're seeing information published, whether it's people trying to do math as far as how many shots were done or what's on the shelf, it's because they're just relying what's in the system, not necessarily what's in an arm. And unlike other reports we've had during the beginning of COVID where we've had systems not working, this is not a system issue, it's a human issue. It takes a human to sit down and enter that information into Florida Shots. Secretary Azar held a news conference 2 days ago, and he released a new plan, which I'll get to in a second, but he also highlighted the nation's challenges with getting out the vaccine. He said two things, which I said to you that we're experiencing here. One, he said, data entry lag. Every state is experiencing data entry lag because historically, they have 30 days to enter the information. And getting providers to enter it in a timely basis so that we can keep track is something they're not used to. In fact, it's kind of ironic, obviously, with all the conspiracy theories about microchips in the vaccines. I can now tell you for a fact, there are no microchips in the vaccines because we can't track the vaccines. Secretary Azar also talked about an over-reliance on hospitals. Again, the problem I outlined here in Florida is a national problem. But Secretary Azar also did something else 2 days ago. And it's something that should make you all proud. They changed their plan. They changed their program. And in fact, even though with all the headlines of the doom and gloom that's happening in the state of Florida, the federal government has copied and pasted our plan. The federal government, just 2 days ago, the CDC, HHS, has asked all states to go to 65 and older, have asked all states to do people with comorbidities, and has asked all states to turn on their pharmacy program. It is identical in every way to our plan, and we were the first state in the nation to roll it out. They also announced allocations in 2 weeks will be based on people who are 65 and older in the states and how fast you can get the vaccine out. Also identical to our plan. And look, with all the problems that I have mentioned, we have done 770,000 shots in the state of Florida. We have used 45% of our first shot allocation. And while I am frustrated that it is not higher, and I've outlined a lot of the reasons why, and I've outlined all the reasons we're working around the clock to get that number up, President-elect Biden has a great quote that I think fits the national distribution program. He says, "Don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative." And among the four biggest states, with Florida only behind Texas, we have used more of our allocation than New York, and we have used almost double the amount of our allocation when compared to California. But look, I'm not satisfied. We're going to continue to do more. We're going to continue to get more shots in arms. I want to bring up one additional issue, because I think it's also been in the news, and I want to address it because I know you're going to have questions. You know, we saw early on of people lining up on a first-come, first-served basis, and of course that's been replayed for the last 3 weeks, even though it only happened once. But at the end of the day, that was not something we instructed them to do. In fact, we were the one who shut it down. That's not appropriate. People should not be lined up on a first-come, first-served basis. Additionally, I want to clear up the issue when it comes to snowbirds or vaccine tourism. Vaccinating snowbirds, people who live here, rent, own a house, pay taxes, contribute to the economy, they are eligible. If they get sick while they're here, which, by the way, we're in snowbird season, and most of them are 65 and older, they wind up in our hospitals. But that is very different than vaccine tourism. Vaccine tourism is not permitted. It is abhorrent. People should not be flying here to get a vaccine and flying out. That being said, I do find it somewhat ironic that if you believe the headlines and Florida was such a disaster on getting a vaccine out, then why are people from around the world flying here to get their vaccine? I want to conclude with this. I know we want to get to the end of this nightmare. I want to get to the end of this nightmare as fast as possible. I know what it's like not to visit a loved one in the hospital right now, or be there with my own dad during his cancer treatments. I know people who have lost loved ones. They couldn't see them in their final moments. They couldn't have proper funerals. It's not lost on me that even while we do everything we can to get this vaccine out, people are going to get sick over the next couple of months, and people are going to die. Trust me, it takes a toll on you every day. People are still going to have to wear masks. We have to be honest with them. We have to tell them they still have to social distance. They have to do the mitigation measures for the foreseeable future, for probably almost all of this year. Dr. Fauci has said it's going to take a year to vaccinate the country. I pray it doesn't take that long. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Director Moskowitz. That was very informative. And before I make some comments, I would like to open it up now to the members who may have questions. Representative Smith, I see you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Leak. And I just want to start by thanking Director Moskowitz. I know that you're committed to this work. You're a true public servant, and you've sacrificed a lot to make sure that we can save as many Floridians' lives as possible. I also appreciate your advocacy on mask wearing. It's really important. And I'm glad that you haven't been hauled out of here for telling us we might have to wear them for the next calendar year. My question for you is meant to try and clarify, because there are multiple stakeholders in this process, whether it be school districts, hospitals, county health departments, that have multiple interpretations on the governor's various executive orders. So I'm hoping that you can clarify for me. In one of the governor's executive orders, he states that hospital providers may vaccinate persons who they deem to be extremely vulnerable to COVID-19. So the question is, if Advent Health were to determine that school district employees approaching 65 with comorbidities are extremely vulnerable, are those hospitals authorized, or is Advent Health authorized under the executive order to administer vaccines to these people?
Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative. So under the executive order, there's a specific caveat that you don't have to be 65 if you have a comorbidity. While the state government did not define comorbidities, the governor wanted to give that flexibility up to hospitals to make those medical decisions. So the ultimate answer to your question is yes.
One more.
Representative Smith, you recognize?
Thank you, Chair Leak, for the follow-up, and thank you, Director Moskowitz, for your answer. I know that right now, or I believe based on your presentation, it appears that bandwidth is not necessarily the big issue. Vaccine supply is a major issue. With that being said, we know that obviously increased vaccine supply is coming. Is partnering with state universities, for example, a way for the state to expand bandwidth for COVID-19 vaccine distribution? I mean, currently in my area, we're looking at the possibility of school districts administering the vaccine, at least through third-party vendors, to their own employees 65 and over. But can universities really help the state expand this capacity using medical school students and things of that nature, just knowing that increased vaccine supply is coming?
Director, you're recognized.
Thank you. Representative, it's a fair question. So because this is not our first rodeo on partnering with people at the local level during this emergency, you know, we went to the universities, obviously, when we needed to figure out testing and things of that nature, and what could they give us? Who was in school? Nursing programs, things of that nature. And so we talked to the universities, and we've partnered with them in tremendous ways. I mean, I can tell you there's so many things that have happened since March, and I can't highlight in all of them. But when we needed ventilators, the university stepped up and basically took the ventilators out of all of their institutions and donated them to hospitals. And so there will be plenty of ways that we can partner with universities. I mean, I can tell you as far as increasing throughput, just the sites that we have, the 70 sites we have, based on supply, we're doing about 23,000 shots there a day. Those sites can be built to do 552,000 shots a day. So it's not an infrastructure issue, right? Again, it goes back to a supply issue. So, I mean, look, we'll continue to talk to the universities and look for ways to partner with them.
Thank you, Director Moskowitz. Representative Jenny, you're recognized.
Chairman, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thank you for allowing me to be on this committee. Director Moskowitz, my friend, first of all, thank you on behalf of Broward County, your home county and mine, and the state of Florida, because I think you've really been, quite frankly, a shining star in this whole thing. Your expertise that you brought to your job has really paid incredible dividends, and I want to thank you for that. One of the other things that I need to thank you is the lines of communication you kept open with me personally. I know every time I called you, if you didn't pick up on the first call, I got a call back in just a few minutes. So thank you for that, and along with your staff, Mr. Rosenstein. There were, though, a few, we had some legislative briefing calls, and I was wondering when the last time we did those, and is there any plan for those moving into the future? Just because I know all of us here, every Democrat, Republican, no matter where you're from in the state, we get a lot of calls, and we don't always have the answers. And quite frankly, your job necessitates you be at the ready for anything emergency-related. So I was wondering when the last one we had and if we'd be having any more of those, and I'll be done with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director.
Thank you, Director. You're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative, I believe the last one we had was in March. You know, that being said, obviously, I talk to all of you. Anytime you call, I usually call you back same day, or my staff does. Obviously, there's 120 of you and there's 40 senators, and so hand-to-hand combat takes a lot of time. There is, you know, for anyone who needs information, any elected official who needs information, not just in this room, but city commissioners, county commissioners, mayors, they all call, and they all get the honest information, transparent, the data they need from us in a timely basis. So, you know, obviously, there are certain things that I schedule, and there are certain things that are out of my control.
Thank you, Director. Representative Driscoll, for a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Moskowitz. I would just echo all the sentiments of the members who have spoken before me. Talk about being in a crucible. We appreciate you. I appreciate the thoroughness of your presentation today and the professionalism with which you brought it. I do have a couple of questions, and I tried to take notes, but still had a couple of follow-up questions. So I heard you mention ALF facilities and that vaccines have been given to 3,000 of them. I don't have a clear understanding of the scope of how many ALFs we have in Florida, though. So could you perhaps speak to that, like what percentage or, you know, roughly what amount of ALFs have received the vaccine, and when can the others expect to receive theirs?
Director.
Sure. So there are 5,000 long-term care facilities. 3,000 of those 5,000 are ALFs. We started with nursing homes. And so all the nursing homes, if are not finished by now by CVS and Walgreens, they should be finished in the coming days. So the vaccine doesn't go directly to the facility. Under the federal contract, the vaccine goes to CVS and Walgreens, who then schedule those trips into the ALFs. When we saw that, obviously, the performance of that federal contract was mediocre, we went out and now are supplementing that with our own teams to make sure that we can finish long-term care facilities on a timely basis. We've gotten CVS and Walgreens to pledge to finish their list of facilities by the 23rd of January. Let's see if that happens. But the state on the list that we've taken is pledged to finish those by the end of the month.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Representative Driscoll for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I did receive feedback from a hospice in my district that they're not receiving the vaccines. Their staff are in and out of hospitals, home, and long-term care facilities. When will hospitals receive the vaccine? And it's my understanding that the particular hospice in my district is registered under the Florida Shots program.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
It's a fair question. So the Surgeon General has said several times that after frontline healthcare workers, hospitals can go vaccinate other healthcare workers. So folks that work in hospice, things of that nature, can go do that home healthcare, all of that stuff. As far as residents in hospice, I don't know yet when we'll be getting to. Mr. Chairman, please.
Not the resident, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Not the residents in hospices, but the staff in hospices. Okay. who are mobile and in and out of homes, et cetera.
Yep. So, Mr. Chairman,
please.
Yeah, those people are eligible now, right? So those people are eligible now. The Surgeon General has said once frontline healthcare workers were done, hospitals could vaccinate anybody who has patient interaction. So any hospitals, any medical staff that has patient interaction is what the Surgeon General has said. So those people are eligible now.
Thank you. Representative Driscoll.
So then hospice workers are not considered frontline workers is the issue, so they would not be in the first category of individuals eligible for the vaccine right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So in the first 2 weeks, we were only doing frontline healthcare workers. Frontline healthcare workers were folks in the hospitals. But now that we have finished frontline healthcare workers, the Surgeon General has said all medical personnel with patient interaction would qualify, and he's asked the hospitals to vaccinate those people. So the staff that you're talking about are eligible.
Thank you. Representative Driscoll.
Final question. So then it sounds like the responsibility really is on the hospitals to push this out and to get it to these hospice workers.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Ranking Member Casello for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director Moskowitz, for being here. Appreciate it, and thank you for your leadership. This is not an easy thing. My question is that, as we know, a second dose of current COVID-19 vaccines is required for a patient to gain peak immunity. And many have received the vaccine, as you stated, but have been given little or no information about how and when the second dose will be available. Is there a plan to have enough vaccine on hand to complete the boosters as required by the manufacturers to achieve full immunity? With 80% of the deaths over 65, as you stated earlier, we know that the immune system tends to weaken with age, and can seniors build the necessary immunity without the second dose? Or will the immunity of those who receive the first dose be compromised of a short duration without a second shot?
Director?
Mr. Chairman. So, Representative, I can't comment on the medical efficacy of that. I can only report that the studies that were done by both Pfizer and Moderna were done with two doses. There are no studies that were done with one, just with one dose. The data does show that you do get a certain amount of protection with the first dose, but you do not get to the 95% efficacy without the second dose. And obviously, there's no data on how just one dose would interact with potentially the new variant of COVID-19. As far as second doses, we received 118,950 second Pfizer doses, next week we will be receiving 138,450 Pfizer doses and 367,900 Moderna doses. Again, found that out on Tuesday of this week based on how the system works. But the good news is, so far, the second doses that correspond with the first doses are arriving. So that is good news. As far as guaranteeing whether or not we're going to continue to have second doses, both the Trump administration and President-elect Biden have talked about taking what they have been holding back for the second dose and pushing it down as fast as possible to the states. Why do they want to do that? Because, again, it's a supply problem, not a distribution problem. If they do that, obviously, I don't have any information to guarantee whether production will then keep up for second shots. That's information the federal government will have to provide.
Thank you, Director. Ranking Member.
Thank you, Chair. Is there a plan to notify these seniors on how to get that second shot?
Director.
Yeah, so, Representative, great question, because I want to make sure that people understand this, get this out. When you go for the first shot under the appointment systems, and I know there's multiple appointment systems, but under the appointment system, they schedule you for the second shot. So when you go and get your first shot, you get scheduled for your second shot. Now, you don't have to get your second shot at the same place. Obviously, that would be much easier for us. But you get a CDC card that shows when you got your first shot, what type of vaccine you got. So you could make an appointment somewhere else to get your second shot in that time frame in the event you did not make an appointment in that same location.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ranking Member. Representative McFarland. And folks, I just want to point out our time here is we got about 8 minutes left, so if we could make sure we leave room for enough folks to ask questions, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Chair Leak. I will try to speak as quickly as he does. Director Moskowitz, thank you so much for the retrospective. It's interesting to reflect on where we were in April and March, and this is sort of where we are again in week five of distribution. And you and your department have accomplished so much of 300 plus days at full out speed. So thank you and your team for all of their work. Does the county distribution allocation contemplate not only the population of each county, but specifically the population that is above 65 years old?
Director.
Yeah, so we are using census data, specifically the 65 and older population. We're not doing it on overall population. We're doing it based on the 65 and older population. Although I will tell you, when you compare regular population and 65 older, the most variance we've seen is about 4%.
Thank you. Representative McFarland.
And a quick follow-up to Representative Smith's question, seeking clarification on the portion of the executive order that covers those with significant underlying comorbidities. Are they to approach their hospital system or their primary care provider? What's the avenue into requesting a dose?
Director.
So the governor has left those medical decisions up to hospitals. The decision was made those decisions are best made up to, obviously, medical professionals than government officials. So the way that would work is you would approach your hospital. It's possible your hospital may not be doing comorbidities. So you would have to approach a hospital that doing folks with comorbidities. Some hospitals are asking for letters from your primary care doctor to show in order to get it, probably just from a liability standpoint. They want to see from a doctor that you're safe to get it. Another reason why we did not want to get into the business of who has a better or worse comorbidity. We didn't want to play that game.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative G. Lombardo. Did I get it right?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair Leak. Thank you, Director. I'm in the National Guard, and I helped set up the C.B. Smith Park and the Hard Rock, and I know that this kind of the vaccine rollout kind of reminds me of those initial days right at when we were doing all the testing, except for the vaccine is going to be a little bit more challenging because more people are going to want it. So my question is you said National Guard can absolutely not provide the vaccines. What's the difference between giving the test for with medics to providing the vaccine to the community?
Director.
Chairman, Representative, so yes, it is exactly like it was in the beginning. I know that because I'm not sleeping again. So the answer is, ultimately, it takes no medical training to swab somebody. It's something that you can train somebody in an hour to do and show how to, what to do and what not to do. And we did that. And there were no medical prohibitions out there on sticking a swab in somebody's nose or in their mouth, right? And in fact, we really only used the National Guard in the beginning because we were building that capacity of nurses. In fact, the National Guard hasn't been swabbing people now for some time, months on end now. We've been only using medical professionals. But National Guardsmen, out of the 10 or 12,000 that we have, there are 150 of them that are trained doctors or nurses to do shots. They have to be trained, they have to be certified. 150 of them out of 10,000. Now, why haven't I deployed those 150? Because I would be pulling them out of a hospital. I would be pulling them up maybe as a paramedic away from their job, serving the community in another capacity. And I can fill that 150 with contract nurses. So that's why it's not happening. And so I've said this before, and I want to be crystal clear, is because a lot of people keep bringing it up. I keep seeing it in articles, and I keep seeing it in letters asking me to activate the National Guard and give them shots. The National Guard's been activated to march, as you know, and Representative Avila knows he was out there also. The National Guard has pulled more than their weight, okay, during this COVID-19 response. But the National Guard cannot increase shots. They cannot increase our throughput. That is not what they're trained to do. It is beyond their capacity, and we're not going to put them in a position that could be dangerous.
Thank you, Director. Representative G. Lombardo, for a follow-up, final follow-up, if we could, please.
Yeah. It'll be quick. Thank you, Chair Leak. One quick follow-up. So as that, I know right now your lead is only 6 days, which is, you can't plan for 6 days. But in the scalability plan, are you planning on using independent pharmacies as well, or is it just going to be the large pharmacies?
Director?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, wonderful question. So we will scale at our sites, like I talked about. Our sites, which are doing 23,000 tests a day now, could go up to 500,000 tests. Just based on, again, more throughput, more lanes, more nurses. And we're partnering with Publix now in the pharmacy program. That pharmacy program, again, based on supply, could be at all 700 Publixes. It could be at the thousands of CVSs and Walgreens. It could be at all of the Walmarts. And it could be at every independent pharmacy, right? So all that independent pharmacy has to do is sign up in shots as a provider. And when we expand to more pharmacies, the answer is yes. In fact, I do believe the forward vision, long-term vision, if we got the supply, is people would get it from their doctor, from their pharmacy, just like the flu vaccine, right? But, you know, right now, we just don't have the supply. If everyone tried to get the flu vaccine right now, we'd run out of supply. So it's just a supply issue. I'm hoping whether the federal government looks at things like the Production Act, which has been discussed, or, you know, based on how much they have on hand, nobody really knows how much they have on hand that potentially might release in 2 weeks. We have been prepared, and we are prepared that if 6 days from now, because that's all the heads up I will get, if they decide to dump a bunch of doses on us, we are prepared to scale up big time in our infrastructure to get that out.
Thank you, Director. And members, I recognize this is a very important opportunity to speak with Director Moskowitz. And with that in mind, Vice Chairman Payne, you're recognized for a motion.
Chair, I move that we extend the meeting 15 minutes.
Thank you. We have a motion to extend the meeting 15 minutes. Seeing no objection, the motion carries. Representative Thompson, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Secretary, for all that you've done during this very challenging time. My question has to do with your very accurate observation that there's a lot of hesitancy within certain communities to take the vaccine. And in African-American communities, that's based on some historical facts, such as the Tuskegee experiment, where African-American men were left untreated for syphilis so that medical professionals could observe what happened to the human body as the disease progressed. People are aware of forced sterilizations of African-American women, the whole Henrietta Lacks cell situation. And so there's a lot of distrust And you mentioned that you're working with churches and faith-based groups. Has that been effective? And what other kinds of things are you doing with regard to public information, public education, so that people are not hesitant to take the vaccine?
Mr. Chair.
Director Moskowitz.
Wonderful question. So early on, when doses went into hospitals and they went to long-term care facilities, obviously it's not mandatory. So people can choose to take the vaccine or not, whether they're staff in a hospital, whether they're a resident in a nursing home. Believe it or not, there are 90-year-olds, right, in nursing homes that are deciding not to take the vaccine. So I looked at the data. And so based on who worked in those facilities or who were in those facilities and based on who was deciding to take the vaccine, it looked at about only about 7% of the vaccine went to the minority community in the first 2 weeks, which is obviously, we know, well below what our population is in the state of Florida. So I tried to think of an innovative way in which I could break through because, you know, we're up here in Tallahassee. We needed to get on the ground with a local validator, somebody that they trust, somebody that could organize pretty quickly. And it just clicked, why not partner with the faith-based community? And so we ran a pilot. We ran that pilot in the city of Brownsville, in Pensacola. Brownsville, with a high African-American population, got hit very hard in Hurricane Sally. And I had done a food mission there and had saw them organize the food mission, and that's kind of what clicked. And so we teamed up with the pastor there and Commissioner May, whose district that is, and we gave out 500 vaccines, wanted to do them all in a day, and the response was overwhelming. And 90% of the people who got the vaccine that day were from the minority community. And so we thought we had something. And so, again, just based on supply and restrictions, the following weekend, just 7 days later, I did 9 of them across the state, all different places. Same response. Seeing that they didn't interface with me, they interfaced with the pastor, right, with their church, their members, they organized. And so we're doing another 9 this weekend. And look, I would do 50 of them each weekend if I could. In fact, I would like to stop opening them and closing them. I'd like to keep them there, right, and run through. But I just don't have enough vaccine. But as far as I'm concerned, and I'm always open to ideas, this seems to be working. And so I want to continue to feed it, because as long as I see that people are coming, that seems to be a really good way to make inroads in the minority community. As far as communicating, just like we did with testing, you know, whether that's elected officials, you know, people on the ground they trust, leaders in the community, we're going to be doing radio, newspapers, advertisements in local publications. But at the end of the day, I really do believe the best way is for the vaccine to happen. Here's what I mean. 500 members of that church go get the vaccine. Their friends see that they're fine. They want the vaccine. That's how it's going to spread. It's going to spread based on word of mouth, building that comfort. That's why getting the vaccine into the minority community as fast as possible to help kind of build that pace. But look, we need local partners. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you, Representative. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you seeking additional local validators and getting individuals who would be trusted in these communities so that you can then contact them, or perhaps we can assist you to contact them so that you have a wider reach? Because obviously, if there are pockets of our population who are left unvaccinated, it makes the whole system less effective. So if that is something that you're looking for, perhaps that's a way that we can assist. And I know that at the federal level, our president-elect, our vice president-elect, got their vaccines publicly, and that was televised so that people could see that they were comfortable And maybe that's something the local validators could do as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Director.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea, Representative. I'd love to work with you on that. Look, early on in testing, we partnered with the Urban League for one of our first testing sites. That was tremendously effective. Again, another local partner on the ground. So if you have suggestions on additional local partners in your area or statewide, I'm more than happy to receive them. And we saw, again, in other communities, when we partnered with folks in Immokalee or an Indian town, you know, partnering with folks on the ground who are in the population day-to-day, that proves to be way more effective than us trying to do this by ourselves.
Thank you, Director. Vice Chairman Payne, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Director Moskowitz, thank you so much for your gargantuan task of fulfilling the unknown that we have going forward. And certainly those of us who have served with you in the House of Representatives know that your credibility and your qualities and your responsibleness of getting this done. So thank you for that. Just a quick question. For those of us that represent rural communities, and I'll give you an example. In Putnam County, we have about 74,000 citizens, 17,000 so are 65 or older. And our efficiency of delivering shots or vaccines has been extremely good. So we get a lot of overflow from local, other local counties like Clay, St. John's, even Volusia. We had 1,300 vaccines last week delivered in 3 days, and this week our supply is zero. And I know that's a supply issue, as you've indicated to us. So we're all clamoring to represent our communities simply because of the supply problem. Is there any consideration of having those centralized counties that can dispense to other counties get an increase in shots? Thank you.
Director.
Thank you. So I fixed that. Okay. On a go-forward basis, no county will be getting zero on a go-forward basis. So that's been addressed. The reason that happened is because we saw, obviously, the lag in reporting. We saw that, obviously, there were a lot of doses in hospitals, again, and depending on reporting, are those doses there, are they not, right? What we needed to do is we needed to put doses in places with tremendous throughput, sites doing 2,000 people a day. So that's where we put doses for about a week, which is why, obviously, there was a drop in allocation. But on a go-forward basis, all 67 counties are going to receive doses every week, and they're going to receive it based on their 65 and older population. So yeah, look, you know, Liberty County will get 100 doses a week based on how much I have to allocate. You know, that's not enough. How are they going to vaccinate their population at that allocation?
Right.
So obviously, you know, that will go up when we get more vaccine. That one of the reasons we turned on Publix, not just to get into the pharmacy. We thought turning that on in the rural communities would be a great way to expand throughput in the rural communities, which is why we did that first in the rural communities with Publix. And as far as, you know, being able to go to different counties and acting as like a hub and spoke model, we're doing that with the county health departments, you know, based on where county health departments have storage. We're doing that kind of hub and spoke model. It's one of the reasons why early on when counties wanted to do a residency requirement that you had to be a resident of a county, I immediately told everyone, no, you can't do that. We got, you know, a dozen plus fiscally constrained counties. People are going to have to cross county lines to get the vaccine. We have transient populations here in the state. We can't do that sort of stuff. It'll have major implications down the road. So I think you're exactly right to continue to do hub and spoke models where you have, you know, one county that has a couple counties around it and that county has slightly more resources. Can we do regional things? We're looking at that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. I have a question for you. You have indicated that the counties receive their allocation of doses based on their population of 65 and older. Can you get a little more into the weeds on that? I hear some claims out there of favoritism and political influence, but if you can get a little more into the weeds on how those doses are allocated to the counties, I would appreciate it.
Sure. So, like I said, in the beginning, when we were trying to increase throughput, bigger sites, a lot of which were set up in more urban areas, okay, we put doses there in order to get doses in arms because we needed to get the shots up when we saw stuff was sitting in hospital. So we called an audible and said, okay, we have 170,000 doses. We want to get these out in 4 days, right? Where can we put them to get them into the community in 4 days? So that's how we did that. On a go-forward basis, what we're doing is we're doing it by population. So obviously I don't have every single solitary area's breakdown, but let me just say this. So if I get 250,000 doses, right, and I take 40,000 off the top for the long-term care facilities, right? That leaves me 210, right? For the Publix missions, we did about 30,000 the previous week. So we take that down. That leaves me about 180,000, right? So if I take that 180,000, then I say, well, I'm doing church missions, right? I take 6,000 off the top for church missions. That takes me down to 174,000. And then if I say I'm going to do a 55 and older pod, meaning I'm going to go to a community of the villages, Sun City, Century Village, and I'm going to do a pod there, which we've been doing, which have been highly successful, I'll say I take 4,000 off for that. So that leaves me 170,000 for all of these sites, right? So what we do then is we take the 65 and older population, we take 170,000, and we do division, right? And it gets ultimately allocated by the population. So under 170,000 math that I have to distribute, Dade County, under their population, would get 22,000 for the week. Broward would get 15,000 for the week. Orange would get 11,000 for the week. Pasco County would get 4,800. I just remember those off the top of my head. But that's how the allocations would work. So what you're hearing is based on how something was previously done, but on a go-forward basis, it's going to be mathematical, it's going to be transparent, and we're going to publish it. Right? So once we know what we have to distribute, we're going to say, this is what we have to distribute. Here's the allocation. We're going to give it out to the county emergency managers so all the counties will understand what's coming.
Thank you, Director. Members, are there any more questions? Any more questions for the Director? I'm sorry. Representative Smith for a question.
Thank you, Chair Leak, for an opportunity for a second bite at the apple. I wanted to change gears real quick back to the PR campaign, if you will, to encourage folks, especially in minority communities, to take the vaccine. What resources does the state have, if anything, to invest in an intentional public relations campaign to educate the public through public service announcements and other tools that we can use to encourage people to take the vaccine?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
So, that's more of a question for the Department of Health, as they're the ones who do the communication on health-related issues. However, I can tell you that the CDC did send down a $1.6 million grant for vaccine communication, and I do know the Department of Health is working on how to draw down all that $1.6 million and how they're going to use it in communications.
Thank you, Director. Representative Driscoll, for a very brief follow-up question.
Very briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Moskowitz, could you help illuminate a question or illuminate some information about the 30,000 that go to Publix? Is that counted in the county allocation? And if not, why not?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that's a funny question because we were literally debating that this week in the office. So based on how many locations we're turning on and throughput, right, we're going to have basically about 100 locations turn on in Publix, I think the governor announced yesterday. So we've allocated 30,000 for those 100 locations. In fact, I think in the coming weeks, you're going to continue to see those allocations rise to get in more and more and more counties. Right now, we're not factoring that into a county's allocation. Why? Most of the stores we've opened are all in the rural areas, and in the rural areas, they've gotten very tiny allocations. So if we took it into account, we would be punishing them, which is why we've not done that. As we get into more urban areas, we will start looking at taking it into account.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. And members, we're going to stop the questions here. I want to take a moment, though, and thank you. Thank you, Jared. Thank you, Director. And thank Governor DeSantis. You've been given an impossible task, and you have been forced to try to chart a course through uncharted waters and answer questions for which there is no single right answer. And I just want to tell you how much I have watched from afar and appreciated the efforts of yourself, your entire staff, Governor DeSantis, to help us find a way through this. So thank you. And members, if you please join me in thanking Director Moskowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Moskowitz. Members, with that concludes our business for today. Ranking Member Casello, is there anything you'd like to say today? Microphone.
There we go. It's good to see all of you here today, and it's a pleasure to be here. Chair Leak and Vice Chair Payne, we're lucky to have your leadership in this committee. Director Moskowitz, thank you for joining us today. Our state owes you a debt of gratitude for amazing work you and your department have done with limited resources, the DMA. I look forward to continuing this good work and getting some results. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chairman Payne, is there anything you'd like to say?
No comment, Chair.
Thank you for no comments. I want to thank you all, and I want to start today by thanking the Speaker and Representative Zika for helping us come out of the gate swinging, moving some substantive legislation in an effort to help us, understanding that this year will be a different year for us. Our committee meetings will be limited in both number and in time in the committee. And so I appreciate all of your indulgence in helping us work through what is an unprecedented situation with committee meetings. And with that, Vice Chairman Payne moves we rise. Seeing no objection, the meeting is adjourned.